A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome. Today we are launching a deep dive into Bryan Stevenson's, well, truly monumental work, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption.
Yeah.
This book isn't just a bestseller. It's really become a foundational text for understanding American justice today.
That's absolutely right. And it's not like ancient history or something. It feels like a living document. Stevenson gives us this incredibly searing, ground-level look at how the American criminal justice system, especially around capital punishment, consistently fails the vulnerable.
The poor people of color.
Exactly. People with mental disabilities. The list goes on.
So why this deep dive right now? Why is Just Mercy still, you know, hitting so hard?
Well, because Stevenson's core argument isn't that the system has a few flaws here and there. He's saying it's structurally broken.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, it's built on distance, maybe even fear, seeking retribution instead of restoration or understanding. He really shifts the whole conversation, insisting that true justice actually requires mercy.
Mercy, not just punishment.
Right. And that we have to cultivate proximity, get close to suffering if we ever want to truly understand injustice. It forces us, you know, you, me, everyone listening, to confront our own role in, well, maintaining the status quo.
Wow. Oh.
Stevenson's central argument is radical in a way, but also pretty simple. Our system is profoundly biased against people who don't have resources.
I'll need connections.
Yeah. And that any real meaningful reform has to be rooted in compassion and moral clarity, not just tweaking legal procedures.
It challenges that really deep-seated idea that justice has to mean harsh punishment, doesn't it?
It really does. Stevenson basically says, no, hold on. Mercy isn't weakness. It's the very foundation we need to build an ethical legal structure on.
So it's kind of an examination of, of how a country that talks so much about equality can keep running a system that just systematically hits the most vulnerable hardest.
Precisely. It's about recognizing our shared humanity, essentially, how that humanity is tied up in how we treat the accused, the condemned, the forgotten.
Right. Let's talk about the author himself then, because the power of this book seems so tied to who he is.
Absolutely. Bryan Stevenson, he's the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI, down in Montgomery, Alabama.
And he's not just writing about this from an ivory tower.
Oh, yeah.
He's in the trenches.
Totally. He's a Harvard law grad, but he chose this path, dedicated his whole career not to, you know, a big corporate firm, but to representing indigent defendants fighting for people on death row.
Often pro bono, taking cases no one else would touch.
Exactly. So his perspective is incredibly unique because he hasn't just studied the problem. He's lived it. He's been there.
And his impact is real. It goes way beyond just individual cases. He's argued before the Supreme Court multiple times.
Yeah, and won. Landmark cases. The most famous is probably Miller v. Alabama.
Ah, yes. Juvenile sentencing case.
That's the one. It banned mandatory life without parole sentences for kids age 17 or younger. A huge shift.
So that victory alone shows you it's not just moral passion. It's backed by serious legal skill.
Definitely. His moral clarity is matched by his legal rigor. He's represented, I think the number is over 125 condemned prisoners, giving them a voice, a real defense, often when they had absolutely nothing.
So when he talks about injustice, he's talking as an eyewitness, someone who's navigated the, well, the darkest parts of the system.
That's exactly right, which gives the book its incredible weight.
Okay, so Just Mercy. It seems like it has sort of a dual mission.
Yeah, you could say that. On one level, it's a powerful memoir. It tells the story of Stevenson's own life, the founding of EJI, his experiences.
But it's also more than that.
Oh, much more. It's a devastating indictment of the systemic injustices that are just woven into the fabric of the American justice system.
And the main story, the kind of narrative backbone that carries all this, is the case of Walter McMillian.
Yes, Walter McMillian, a black man in Monroeville, Alabama.
Monroeville? Wait, that's Harper Lee's hometown. To Kill a Mockingbird?
The very same town. The irony is just thick. McMillian was wrongly sentenced to death in 1987.
Wrongly sentenced.
Completely innocent. Stevenson uses his six-year nightmare on death row as this incredibly vivid case study. It shows exactly how poverty, race, and frankly, judicial bias can just converge and destroy an innocent person's life.
So McMillian's story is central, but the book branches out from there. It's not just about him.
No, not at all. It's more like a mosaic of failure, really. Stevenson explores the death penalty, how it's applied in such a discriminatory way.
And the treatment of children?
Yes, the cruelty of treating kids as adults in the legal system, sentencing 13-year-olds to life without parole, and the shocking lack of protection for defendants with severe mental illness or intellectual disabilities.
So all these different threads.
They weave together this tapestry, and the overarching message becomes crystal clear. Mass incarceration today isn't some kind of weird anomaly. Stevenson argues it's a direct continuation of America's history.
Slavery, lynching, Jim Crow.
Exactly. Just adapted. Dressed up in modern legal clothes, but serving a similar function of racial control.
Okay, let's dig into Walter McMillian's case a bit more. That irony of it happening in Monroeville is just unsettling.
Deeply unsettling. He was accused of murdering a young white woman. And part of the reason he became a suspect, apparently, was because he, a black man, was having an affair with a white woman in the community.
So that immediately made him a target, regardless of evidence.
It certainly seems that way. It shows how that underlying racial fear was driving things long before any real facts were gathered. I mean, the actual case against him was unbelievably flimsy.
Flimsy how?
Well, for starters, McMillian had multiple reliable witnesses, dozens, in fact, all testifying he was miles away at a church fish fry when the murder actually happened.
Dozens of witnesses. Okay, so what did the state have?
Their entire case pretty much rested on the testimony of one guy, a convicted felon named Ralph Myers.
And his testimony was solid.
Not even close. It came out later, through EJI's work, that Myers was heavily coerced by law enforcement. They threatened him, basically, with the electric chair himself, until he agreed to lie and point the finger at McMillian.
Wow. Coerced testimony, alibi witnesses ignored. Then what happened at the trial?
Well, another shocker. The trial itself was moved to a predominantly white county, even though the crime happened elsewhere. And after all that, the jury actually listens to the evidence, considers the weak case, and recommends a life sentence.
Okay, so life, not death.
But then, the trial judge, a man named Robert E. Lee Key, he uses this power called judicial override. He just throws out the jury's recommendation.
He overruled the jury?
Yes, and imposed the death penalty himself.
That's just... It screams bias, doesn't it? It feels like the system was determined to get him no matter what.
It sets the tone immediately. It shows how systemic bias could just steamroll the limited mercy the jury tried to offer. The local power structure seemed intent on that conviction.
So McMillian's case shows the legal corruption, the bias. But Stevenson broadens the lens, you said, to show other kinds of vulnerability.
He does. He spends a lot of time on the tragedy of children being processed as adults. I mean, the idea that a 13 or 14-year-old whose brain isn't even fully developed could be sentenced to die in prison.
Like without parole.
Yeah. It's something he fought against relentlessly.
You mentioned Ian Manuel earlier.
Right. Ian Manuel. He was just 13 when he was involved in an attempted robbery where someone was tragically shot. He got convicted and sentenced to life without parole in an adult maximum security prison at 13.
Stevens's argument there is... It's different for kids, right?
Fundamentally different. He argues sentencing a child who is still developing morally and cognitively to life imprisonment just denies the very possibility of redemption, of change.
It focuses less on just pure retribution and more on acknowledging how children process things like fear, trauma, peer pressure differently.
Exactly. And that connects to how the system also ignores other mitigating factors like mental health and trauma, even in adults.
Like the Jimmy Dill case.
Yes, Jimmy Dill. Executed despite having significant intellectual disabilities that made it incredibly hard for him to even understand the legal proceedings against him.
Or cases involving severe trauma, like veterans with PTSD or abused women.
Right. Marsha Colby is another case he discusses. Convicted of murder after killing her abusive husband. The courts basically dismissed years of documented profound domestic violence and trauma. It wasn't seen as relevant context.
So in all these stories, the system isn't seeing the full picture, the human being.
It fails to see the context of the crime.
Yeah.
It often ends up punishing brokenness rather than trying to understand root causes or offer any kind of healing.
Okay, so back to McMillian. EJI fights for him for years.
6 long years on death row. They fight relentlessly, and they eventually uncover what are called Brady violations.
Right. Brady violation, that means the prosecution illegally hid evidence.
Exactly. Evidence that was favorable to McMillian, evidence proving that Myers, the star witness, was coerced and had lied. It's basically the prosecution cheating to win.
And they managed to get public attention on the case.
Yes, that was crucial. They got a major segment on 60 Minutes. That public spotlight finally put enough pressure on the system.
And the conviction was overturned.
Finally. The Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals overturned it. McMillian walked free after 6 years facing execution for a crime he didn't commit.
An incredible victory.
Yeah.
But not a simple happy ending.
No. Stevenson is very clear about this. Exoneration doesn't erase the scars. McMillian struggled immensely with the trauma, the anxiety. He eventually developed severe dementia. The cost of injustice, even when corrected, is permanent.
That's heavy. So after reading all these devastating stories, what's the bigger message? What does Stevenson want us to take away philosophically?
Well, there are a few core insights, transformative ideas, really. The first and maybe the most important is what he calls the power of proximity.
Getting close.
Yeah. He argues you just cannot achieve true justice from a comfortable distance. You have to get close to suffering, close to the marginalized, because proximity, he believes, is the antidote.
The antidote to what?
To the fear and anger that fuels so much systemic injustice. When you're close, you see the humanity. You can't rely on stereotypes.
Which connects right into the second theme, doesn't it? Changing the narrative.
Exactly. We have to actively reject those simplified, dehumanizing labels, you know, super predator, monster, whatever the term of the day is.
Instead, insist on the full story.
Yes. Tell the full human story, including the context, the abuse, the poverty, the mental illness that shaped the person and their actions.
Okay, proximity, changing the narrative.
Yeah.
What's the third big one?
The historical link. This is huge in the book. Stevenson powerfully connects modern mass incarceration directly to the legacy of slavery, lynching, and Jim Crow segregation.
He's saying it's not separate, it's continuation.
Pretty much. He argues the ideology of racial difference, the thing that justified slavery and Jim Crow, it didn't just vanish, it adapted. Well, the mechanisms of control shifted. After slavery, you had lynching and racial terror to maintain the hierarchy. After the civil rights movement achieved legal equality, he argues, that control became institutionalized.
Through things like harsh policing, mandatory minimums.
Exactly. The war on drugs, mass incarceration, all disproportionately targeting Black communities. It's the same underlying ideology, just wearing different clothes.
That's a really crucial point. And there's one more theme, maybe more personal, about hope.
Yes. His personal philosophy of hope as resistance, Stevenson is very clear. Despair is the enemy of justice. Despair serves the unjust system because it makes you give up.
So hope isn't just like wishful thinking for him?
Not at all. For him, hope is a discipline. It's something you have to practice. It's what's required to keep fighting against overwhelming odds day after day, case after case, even when it looks bleak.
Wow. Okay. His writing itself is also really powerful, isn't it? Full of lines that just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. His language is as impactful as his legal work. The book is packed with these, like, aphorisms that make you stop and reevaluate things.
Like this one, which feels like the moral compass for the whole book. Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done.
That one is so fundamental. It demands that we see human dignity as inherent, not something you earn or something you can lose because of one terrible act.
It's essential if you want a system that believes in redemption.
Right.
Not just punishment.
Exactly. A system that sees the potential for rehabilitation.
Okay, here's another one that really challenges economic thinking. The opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice.
Yeah, that's profound. He's arguing that poverty isn't just about lack of money. It's fundamentally about a lack of fair treatment, a lack of access to the legal system.
So if you're poor, you can't afford a decent defense.
Right. And you're far more likely to get swept up, chewed up, and destroyed by the system, even if you're innocent. So in that sense, a lack of justice is a form of structural poverty. It creates and perpetuates poverty.
Okay, and one more, which really sums up EJI's mission, I think. The true measure of our commitment to justice is how we treat the poor, the disfavored, the accused, the incarcerated, and the condemned.
That just cuts right through the political noise, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He forces us to recognize that a society's real moral character isn't revealed in the halls of power.
It's revealed in the shadows.
Exactly. Yeah. In the darkest corners where the most vulnerable people are. How we treat them, that's the true test.
So bringing this down to earth,
yeah,
for someone listening who feels moved by this, maybe angry, maybe inspired,
mm-hmm,
what does Stevenson suggest we do? How can you apply these big ideas?
Well, a big part of it translates directly into civic engagement, being an informed citizen, understanding that, you know, those local elections for judges and district attorneys, they matter hugely.
Because those officials have so much power.
Immense power, often unchecked power. They decide who gets charged, what charges to bring, what plea deals to offer. They set the tone for justice in a community. So paying attention there is critical.
And on a more personal level, he talks about stone catching.
Right. That's a reference to the biblical story, you know? Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. It means actively choosing compassion over condemnation.
How do you practice that?
It means really questioning your own biases, your stereotypes about people who are incarcerated or accused of crimes, seeking out the fuller story, like we talked about, resisting the urge to just judge and dismiss.
And practically speaking.
Well, supporting organizations doing the work on the ground, like EJI and others fighting for reform, but also advocating for alternatives to just locking people up.
Addressing root causes.
Yes. Demanding solutions that tackle poverty, lack of education, the mental health crisis. We need to be critical consumers of news about crime, always asking, okay, but what's the full story here?
Okay, final takeaways.
Yes.
As we wrap up this deep dive, what's one thing that really stands out for you? Maybe something that surprised you or stayed with you?
You know, for me, it's that profound connection he draws between historical racial terror, slavery, lynching, and what's happening in courtrooms and prisons today.
That direct line.
Yeah. He makes it so clear that we can't truly fix the current system until we honestly confront the really ugly foundational truths about American history. Just that mercy isn't just a law book. It feels more like a necessary confrontation with the American conscience.
Yeah.
It reminds us that, in a way, we're all broken. And we all desperately need mercy.
That's powerful. For me, I think the lasting insight is how Stevenson frames hope, that it's not passive, it's an active, demanding discipline. It would be so easy to just despair when you see the scale of injustice.
Right, it's overwhelming.
But he shows that by choosing proximity, by focusing on one case, one person, you actually can force meaningful change. That shift from just feeling helpless to taking hopeful action, even small action, that feels incredibly important. This is definitely a journey we should all commit to.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.